From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, back to the roots of rock and roll with Dave Alvin. In the first half of the 80s, he and his brother Phil led the roots rock band The Blasters. Dave wrote the songs and played lead guitar. Then Dave was the guitarist for X. Now he's writing songs for himself, and he's just released his second solo album. Also today, the afterlife of Elvis. Rock critic Real Marcus is the author of the new book, Dead Elvis, about the many manifestations of the king since his death. It's the story of an American obsession. We have a review of the book and an interview with the author. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The European community is attempting to withdraw its monitors from Dubrovnik as Yugoslav federal forces continue to attack the historic port city in Croatia. Pierre Vickery in Zagreb has more.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians have again spent the day in underground shelters as the Yugoslav Air Force bombed targets throughout Croatia and pro-Serbian artillery units pounded dozens of urban centers. The heaviest hit cities were the medieval Adriatic port of Dubrovnik and the eastern border town of Vukovar, where more than 8,000 shells fell during the day. Croatian radio reported that at least 10 people were known to have died in Dubrovnik, saying the death toll could rise dramatically when rescuers evacuate an air raid shelter filled with women and children destroyed by federal fire. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Diplomatic sources at the United States said today that the UN is not prepared to send a peacekeeping force to Yugoslavia at this time. Despite a call from the Yugoslav president, the UN says there's been no official request for a UN president from Yugoslavia's leadership. European community nations on the Security Council continued today to discuss a possible oil embargo against Yugoslavia. President Bush today hailed the nation's war veterans in a speech at Arlington National Cemetery. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush recounted the history of this country's war since the end of World War I, known for a while as the war to end all wars, only to be followed by the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, and then Desert Storm. We can never know which war will be the last, said the president.
And yes, we hope, we pray, that as the years progress, the face of war will recede into our distant memory. But the memory of our veterans and their sacrifice will never fade.
Quoting President Calvin Coolidge, Mr. Bush said, "The nation which forgets its defenders will itself be forgotten." I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Secretary of State James Baker warned today that a nuclear arms race between the two Koreas poses the biggest threat to security in Northeast Asia. Baker was in Tokyo on the first stage of his Asia trip. He met today with Japanese Prime Minister Keiichi Miyazawa for talks on the Korean arms issue, trade, and Japan's global responsibilities. Baker charged that North Korea has repeatedly failed to comply with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and he said that North Korea is attempting to develop nuclear arms and has refused to permit international inspection of its nuclear facilities. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 3 points to close at 3,042.26. Advances edged declines in light trading. This is NPR. South Africa's biggest mining union charged today that outside agents provoked 3 nights of violence at a gold mine in which at least 69 black people were killed. Officials at the Anglo-American Mining Company acknowledged that 2 of the men killed in the violence were not mine employees, but refused to speculate on their role in the fighting. The company blamed the first round of fighting on mine workers who are trying to force other employees to observe a 2-day general strike. A German court has sentenced 8 neo-Nazis to jail for an attack last spring on visiting children from the Chernobyl area. Deirdre Berger has more.
Last May, the group of 56 children from the region near Chernobyl in the Soviet Union were invited for a short holiday at a children's home in Sittau in the eastern part of Germany. A group of right-wing radicals attacked the home, terrifying the children and injuring an adult supervisor. Local prosecutors did not investigate the attack until months later, when a wave of similar right-wing attacks against foreigners throughout Germany got international attention. The court sentenced the eight defendants, who are between 18 and 34, to jail. The longest sentence was 15 months. During the trial, the young men showed no signs of remorse for their actions. The court said it hoped the sentence would send a signal that attacks against foreigners are punishable offenses. There have been hundreds of incidents of anti-foreigner violence in the eastern and western parts of Germany since August. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
An Afghan rebel official said today in Moscow that he's had indications of support from a high official of the Russian Republic. Such a position would be a reversal of Soviet policy because the Soviet government has supported the Marxist government in Kabul throughout the conflict. Masoud Kalini told reporters that he received the assurance of support from Russian Vice President Alexander Rutskoy. Rutskoy's office said it would have no comment until the talks are over tomorrow. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As rock music has gotten more technically and electronically advanced, and in some cases more pretentious as well, there's been a wave of bands going back to the roots of the music, back to blues, R&B, and rockabilly. One of the American bands at the forefront of that movement in the early 80s was the Blasters. The group was led by Phil and Dave Alvin, two brothers from a working-class neighborhood in L.A. Phil was the lead singer. Younger brother Dave wrote the songs and played lead guitar. After several albums, Dave left the band in 86. He played guitar with X for a while, then went solo. He's just released his second solo album called Blue Boulevard. Before we meet him, let's hear the title track.
This empty road in this lonely town, no one's up when the sun goes down.
Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You, for years, wrote songs for other people. In the Blasters, you wrote songs that your brother Phil would sing.
Yeah.
How is it different writing for you?
With my brother, for example, he was probably the pickiest person as far as what words. He would sit down with me, and we'd go word by word through a song, and he'd go, no, I don't like that. Get that out of there. Use was, or, you know. And I'd have to write things that he and I had shared, experiences or environmental things. Like, I had one song that I wrote called The Border Radio, and he and I grew up listening to border radio stations, so it's like, okay, he can relate to this, I can relate to this. And then towards the end of the Blasters, I just kind of ran out of things that we had shared, you know. I couldn't write real personal songs because I'd gone through things that he hadn't gone through and vice versa. And so I think probably the major difference is I don't have a censor. You know, I think every writer, has a censor inside of them saying, this stinks, you know. And by not having to worry about what someone else would sing, got rid of a sort of a needless censor and just left me with my own personal censor, which also says this stinks, you know.
This will sound like a B movie or something. But did you ever feel
that's my life?
But did you ever feel when you did write something that was reasonably personal, and your brother or somebody else sang it, like, well, everybody thinks that this is about them, that this is from their gut, that this is what they're feeling, but it's really about me.
Yeah. Well, I'd get upset sometimes when a lot of people, when they see someone singing a song, especially in the post-Dylan era, they think the person singing it is the person who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember in the early days of Blasters, before like people knew who wrote the songs and who, you know, whatever, sang them, I'd always get a little like, people would come backstage and say to my brother, "Boy, that's a great song you got there. You wrote a great song there," you know. And he's always been real, well, no, my brother David wrote that, but it still got frustrating because, you know, it just got frustrating, let's put it that way.
Okay, and in talking about writing personal songs that you couldn't write for somebody else, I want to play a song called Andersonville. I don't know if this comes under that category or not. It's really not about you. It's about a soldier during the Civil War who fights on the Union side and ends up in a Confederate prison.
Yeah, but it's about my great-great uncle or great-great granduncle, a guy named Asa Powell, who died in Andersonville, and we were, I guess I was about 8 years old, 7 years old, and I got this box, a little tiny box from my Aunt Margaret, who's sort of the historian of the family. And inside the box were two photographs of him, one on tin, which was a photograph of him when he enlisted, and he was, you know, like 17, 18 years old, and had this big bright face, and he's in his uniform, and he's all happy. And then there's a photograph from about 3 or 4 years later from Andersonville on glass, just this very, very cheap, very, you know, almost, you can barely see it now. It was so, you know, sort of cheaply done. And he is, you know, like I said, 3 years older, and he looks 70. So that's always been like, you know, I guess my connection with some kind of past. We were not a real, family that went in for the genealogy stuff, but that was like this living thing. And anyway, when I decided to start writing songs again and make a record, that was actually the song that did it. I was looking through that stuff one day, this was about a year and a half ago, and all of a sudden, a little bell went off in my head. Said, "This would be a great song, you know." And then I thought, just let me prattle on for a while. and then I thought, Dave, there's a reason why you're not top of the pops. You know, no one writes Civil War songs anymore, especially where people die. You know, and so I wrote the song and played it for a couple people. And the first person I played it for, his reaction was, "Oh, thanks, Dave. Can I commit suicide now?" and I really thought I was a jerk. And then about 2 months later, the Ken Burns thing, the PBS Civil War show, came on. And I went, you know, instantly I went from being a jerk to being a cliche. You know, it's like, oh, man, I can't put this out. This is now, boy, and everybody's going to say he's trying to get on PBS or something. And I actually wasn't going to put the song on the record, but the producers talked me into it. It's a personal song in the sense that it's probably, for me, in a weird way, the funnest song to sing, because I can get out a lot of frustrations it does tie into my personal life, and I can't go into it because I'd probably be sued or something, but it's a very... I'm going to mispronounce this word, but it's a very cathartic thing to sing, if that makes any sense.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a song about death and depression and isolation, and so who couldn't relate to some of that? Well, let's that sounded pretty grim, didn't it? Oh, getting into a mood here.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear Andersonville, and this is from Dave Alvin's new album, Blue Boulevard.
In the spring of 61, I kissed my mother goodbye. I put on a blue uniform and I fought for Lincoln's side. until I got caught by Johnny Reb in the woods near Chapel Hill. And I wish to God he'd have killed me then, but he sent me to Andersonville. My uniform has faded, and there's no boots upon my feet. And I'm pulling worms out of the mud, 'cause there's nothing else to eat. And the Reds can't even feed their own, so there's no bellies of the Yankees starving in Andersonville.
That's some of Andersonville from Dave Alvin's new album Blue Boulevard. Well, just to make matters perhaps a little bit more depressing, I think you were actually kind of ill when you were writing the song. I know you had meningitis for a while, and
yeah.
It seems like you probably wrote this during that period.
Wrote it right after. And, yeah, I guess maybe a stay in the hospital would definitely make you think you're in a prison camp. I don't know. I'm not good with confined spaces.
What are the symptoms of meningitis? What was that period like for you?
Well, I didn't know I had anything. I was on tour. I was doing this this band with Mojo Nixon and a guy named Country Dick Montana. We put together a 19-piece sort of Vegas Billy group, using the theory that we wanted to see what it'd be like in 20 years from now when we'd all sort of wound up playing in Vegas, but we wanted to do it 20 years before just to get used to it. And we were on tour doing that, and I hate to say this, but I'm one of these guys that, doctor? No, I don't need a doctor. I'm fine, you know. And I thought I just had a really bad cold, you know. I neglected to, you know, I didn't take into consideration the fact that I couldn't walk or that my entire body was covered with a rash, you know. And but it was just, you know, one of those stupid things where when I'd get on stage, everything would be fine, you know, and it would be, you know, rock and roll and sweaty and all that. Then as soon as the show was over, you know, I needed a cane and I was walking with my back bent and everything. And so I wound up in the hospital out on the road. And
it seems like you emerged from that experience with new energy to write songs again.
Yeah, well, it wasn't like the movies, you know. I wish it was, you know. I'm out of the hospital now, I want to write songs. But there were just certain things that kind of gives you that power to be unpopular, you know, that power to be yourself. And you know, the one thing about playing the kind of music that I play is people from day one have been saying, why do you want to play that? Why don't you, you know, you're never going to get anywhere playing that stuff. And whether this was in, like when I was in high school and my brother and I, you know, the only things we were interested in were, you know, Big Joe Turner and T-Bone Walker and Muddy Waters and Hank Williams, and everybody else was into whatever they were into, and they were all, why do you guys like that old stuff? Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. And don't invite them to parties. They'll bring their records, you know. and I remember when we started the Blasters, and we were, like, trying to get gigs, and we were going to, like, we would go to country bars and play, you know, like, audition nights and stuff, and the country musicians would come over and say, gee, you guys are real good, but you're not going to get anywhere playing that stuff you're playing. And then we go to, a hard rock club, an audition there, you know, do these things where you go and you play for free, and then the people in the audience come and say, what are you playing that for? Why don't you play such and such, such, that's what people want to hear. And so my whole life has been kind of that, you know. It's kind of, everybody wants to tell you what to do and how to fit in, and they all know what's best, you know.
Singer-songwriter and guitarist Dave Alvin is my guest. He has a new album called Blue Boulevard. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Alvin. Let's hear something from his days with the Blasters. This is Marie Marie. Dave wrote it and is featured on lead guitar. Brother Phil does the vocals.
Marie Marie, playing guitar on the back porch. I sit in my car while she sings so sad. Marie Marie, Marie Marie, it's so lonely.
What did the early Blasters sound like before you started recording?
Before we started recording, we sounded more like the Ramones. because that's really what got us back into music was
punk.
Yeah, it was the Ramones and the Clash and stuff like that. Because we'd all kind of gotten day jobs. I was a fry cook, and the bass player was working in a factory, and the drummer was working in some factory, and my brother was teaching math. And I had even gotten to the point where I grew up like a Solzhenitsyn beard down to my chest, because I just figured, well, you know, I'm using sort of the thinking of the time. I was like, well, I'm 21, my life's over, you know. And it sounds funny, but I mean, from about the age, like I said, of 12 until about 16, we were hanging in blues bars, and then that kind of disappeared. And so by the time I was 21, it really did kind of seem like life was over.
Did you ever, with the Blasters or with X, play in any of the punk clubs in Los Angeles or anywhere else?
No, we never did anything. What do you tell? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, what do you want to know?
Well, you really liked the music and played the music, but how did you relate to the audience?
Well, in the early days, I felt like, in the early days, before even we got the Blasters together, I mean, I was going to punk shows, so I felt like I was the audience, you know, I was part of the audience. And in the early days of the Blasters, we would go, you know, we would... Our itineraries were hilarious in a way, something that could never happen today. We would play like a Tuesday night at a country bar, Wednesday night at a biker bar. Thursday night we'd open for a new wave band, not punk, but we'd open for a new wave band. And then on Friday night we'd open for a Black Flag, you know. and we would tend to go over with just about everybody we got up in front of, you know. And I mean, we did a tour once with this English band, arena band called Queen, and they had seen us playing in a bar, and we, at that time, hadn't had any records, and we were just playing the, you know, that sort of circuit I just explained, the country biker new wave punk circuit. And we went out in front of the Queen's audience unannounced. You know, they didn't put our name on a marquee or anything, and so there'd be like 17,000 people throwing cherry bombs and beer bottles and whatever they could at us. And that was the Queen, you know, mainstream rock audience, and the Black Flag audience, or the Cramps audience, or the Circle Jerks audience, or you know, the X audience. Those bands that we would open for in our early days, their audience was, you know, they just slam and hit each other. You know, they wouldn't throw stuff at us, so it didn't bother me. You know, those were fun days. I mean, there was. I'm going to sound like an old man here for a second, but. There was a lot of, especially in L.A., and I'm sure it was true, you know, in other cities in the country, but in L.A. there was this real us versus them thing, Which when you're in your early 20s is a great kind of feeling, you know.
Who was then the record industry and mainstream rock?
And, yeah, and the world, you know, the whole world. It's, if you were, yeah, you know, they were signing bands that, that, you know, were obviously exploitation bands, but they wouldn't sign, you know, X couldn't get a major label deal. The Blasters couldn't get any kind of deal. At that point, even a band, you know, like the Go-Go's couldn't get a deal. You know, I'm talking like 1980, around in there. And that created a real thing, a real sense of camaraderie between the between all these groups. And those, for that reason, those were really wonderful times. I mean, there was a lot of excessive behavior and this, that, and the other that that now we frown on. But it was pretty incredible, you know, and you know, I mean, I have two of my favorite periods of my life are hanging out with, you know, being a little kid with Big Joe Turner and living a couple years during that L.A. rock scene. That was pretty good.
How did you get to hang out with Big Joe Turner?
We just followed him. I mean, there's a long story. I mean, we literally followed him until they took notice. They couldn't help, you know. And my brother would go up. My brother, already at the age of, like, whatever, 14, could sing exactly like Big Joe Turner. And Big Joe just loved that, you know. Or we'd already been collecting 78s, so when we'd go see Lowell Folsom or T-Bone Walker, we could say, you know, oh, well, we got your record, you know, from 1941 or 42, and they would be floored.
In addition to writing lyrics, you write poems.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes something that really frightens me, because sometimes, because sometimes the poems aren't nearly as good as the lyrics. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of people who write kind of bad poetry, and you try to not get into it. but I really like your poems, and I thought I'd ask you to read one, and I thought I'd ask you to read one that seemed very unlike the kind of subject you'd write a song about. And the poem is called My Mother Fell.
Okay.
You're welcome to introduce it if you'd like.
Yeah, usually, my mother was dying, and that's really, I guess that says it all, I guess. My mother fell this afternoon. My mother fell and hit her head on grandmother's jagged wooden table. Strips of her flaky skin clung to the table's sharp edge. I let go of her. I let go of her because she said she was cold. I left her standing alone in her walker as I went for her sweater. But the drugs or the chemotherapy had taken away her coordination, and she lost her balance in her walker, and she fell. I let go of her. My mother fell this afternoon like she was a baby, taking her first steps. The pink skin of her forehead quickly turned purple. A small slash of blood dripped into her half-closed eyes. My mother fell this afternoon, and my tears fell into her eyes as I tried to lift her back up. My mother fell this afternoon, my tears with her blood. My mother fell this afternoon. My mother fell.
I think it's a wonderful poem.
Oh, thanks.
Could you ever do a song like that?
I don't know. Maybe these days, yeah. You know, maybe these days I'm probably, I mean, if I can write something like Andersonville or something, I could probably do that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Singer, songwriter, and guitarist Dave Alvin. His new solo album, Blue Boulevard, is on High Tone Records. Dave Alvin performs tonight in Philadelphia and later this week in Washington, D.C. and New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Elvis Presley has had many lives since his death. Americans continue to have visions of Elvis. He still makes headlines in the tabloids. The many manifestations of Elvis in the 14 years since he died is the subject of the new book, Dead Elvis, by rock critic Real Marcus. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews the book, then we speak with its author about America's continuing obsession with the king. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Heavy fighting continues in Yugoslavia amid signs that the warring factions in the civil war are now looking beyond Europe for help in settling their dispute. Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
With the failure of the European community to mediate an end to the Yugoslavian civil war, the republics of Serbia and Croatia are turning to the United Nations for help. This weekend, Serbia and its allies among the Yugoslav republics wrote to the UN Security Council asking it to send a peacekeeping force to establish a buffer zone between Serbian and Croatian troops. It marked the first time since the crisis began that Serbia endorsed outside intervention. The Serbian request coincided with a bloody escalation in the assault by its Federal Army troops on the medieval Croatian town of Dubrovnik. Shelling today was so intense that the European community decided to withdraw its monitoring teams inside the city. Croatia also wants the UN to set up a buffer zone, but both sides disagree about where the zone should be. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
In a show of defiance, parliament members in Russia have refused to go along with a call by President Boris Yeltsin to declare a state of emergency in Chechen-Ingush. If that declaration is not repealed, the leader of the Muslim region has threatened attacks on Moscow's nuclear power stations and subways. The parliament vote is not binding, but may force the Russian leader to change his decree. If Yeltsin had ordered troops to open fire in the area, violence could have spread to other parts of the Russian Federation. Secretary of State Baker is on an 8-day trip to Asia, a trip intended to improve relations with Japan and strengthen U.S. ties with China, to try to head off the emergence of North Korea as a nuclear power. Barry Schweid has more on the story.
For a traveling man, Baker has paid little attention to Asia, steering Arabs and Israelis to a peace conference and overseeing the transition in Europe and what he has called a post-Cold War era have had higher priority, and they still do. But Japan's economic strength and the fact that the U.S. trades far more with Asia than with Europe made Baker's trip essential. He's not the first Secretary of State to try to persuade the Japanese to buy more American products in order to ease a one-sided trade imbalance. But he's trying, and in South Korea, he will consult on the specter of North Korea becoming a nuclear power. Baker's hope is that North Korea will open its facilities to international inspection. Then in China, Baker will make what is likely to be a subdued pitch for improvement in human rights. There, too, trade is not in the U.S.'s favor. All this could lead up to a rescheduling of the trip to Asia that President Bush called off last week. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 3 points to close at 3,042.26 on volume of 129 million shares. This is NPR News. Lane Kirkland, head of the AFL-CIO, says that if Democratic presidential candidates want the support of organized labor, they have to be on the side of the American worker. At the union's annual convention, Kirkland said that to have labor support, candidates have to support a ban on the permanent replacement of strikers, have a plan for health care reform, and promise to help those out of work. In a silent protest against the Bush administration, Labor Secretary Lynn Martin has not been invited to the Labor Convention. In South Africa, officials of a violence-plagued mine have temporarily closed down part of their operations and sent thousands of workers home. The fighting began last week when miners supporting a general strike tried to stop others on their way to work. Fergal Keane of the BBC reports.
It now appears that the violence has mainly involved COSA-speaking supporters of the ANC and migrant labourers from Lesotho who refused to participate in last week's anti-VAT strike. It must be emphasised that in spite of the high death toll, the violence at the President's Stain mine is localised. There has so far been no sign of it spreading to any of the other major gold, coal or platinum mines. The Anglo-American Corporation is hoping that by sending the workers home for a period, the situation can be defused. The organisation has declined to formally comment on claims by the National Union of Mine Workers that the fighting was sparked off by a so-called third force, intent on promoting factional unrest among blacks. That allegation will, however, be investigated by the Standing Commission on Violence, which was set up in terms of the National Peace Agreement, and which Anglo-American has called on to investigate the violence.
Virgil King of the BBC. Close to a dozen people were wounded when Israeli troops and their Lebanese allies shelled two villages in southern Lebanon. Sent shortly before Middle Eastern talks, a pro-Iranian faction is vowed to step up guerrilla warfare. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Real Marcus has written a new book about what Elvis Presley has been up to in the past 14 years since his death. No, the king hasn't returned in a vision to speak to Greil Marcus, but Marcus has been keeping track of how Elvis, after death, has continued to manifest himself in our imaginations and in our hallucinations. It's the subject of Marcus's new book, Dead Elvis. We'll talk with Greil Marcus about his own collection of Elvis tabloid headlines, confessions, biographies, parodies, etc. But first, Maureen Corrigan has a review of the new book, Dead Elvis.
15 years ago, Greil Marcus wrote a book called Mystery Train that lots of people, including me, think is the smartest book on rock and roll ever written. One particular passage from Mystery Train has always stuck in my head. Marcus writes, "Good art is always dangerous, always open-ended. Once you put it out in the world, you lose control of it. People will fit it into their lives in all sorts of different ways." That's for sure. 200 years ago in Europe, Goethe's blockbuster novel, The Sorrows of the Young Werther, sparked a fad for suicide among its readers. On a cheerier note, a student came to see me the other day and announced that reading Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl had made him decide to study poetry instead of economics. I'm not sure his parents are thrilled, but I am. Marcus is right. Good art is dangerous. In his new book, Dead Elvis, Marcus investigates how Americans have been fitting not Elvis Presley's art, but Elvis Presley the artist into their lives during the 14 years since he died. Marcus has gathered together and expanded a lot of reviews and essays he's written about Elvis's strange afterlife. He discusses phenomena like a San Francisco radio show called Breakfast with Elvis, where listeners phone in their recipes for imaginary breakfasts to satisfy Elvis's king-sized appetite. He digs up a cartoon strip entitled Invasion of the Elvis Zombies and a sex solicitation ad that offers curious readers the chance to make love to an Elvis lookalike. Nothing about Elvis's beyond-the-grave existence is too bizarre or banal for Marcus to consider. Marcus believes that Elvis was a conscious artist, not just a folky exemplar of the people. He compares Elvis to figures like Abraham Lincoln and Herman Melville. He says they all present us with a fantasy of what the most extreme possibilities and dangers of our national identity are. When we read Lincoln's second inaugural address, Marcus says, we feel ennobled and a little scared because we realize what we are and what we are not. We pull back. Marcus claims the same thing happens when we listen to Elvis's early music. It's both thrilling and painful. We need to keep Elvis alive to figure out what he's been doing to us all this time. The catch-22 of writing an extraordinary book like Mystery Train is that reviewers will always hold you up to the Olympian standards you set for yourself. Dead Elvis, mostly because it's just a collection of loosely related pieces, is only a good, not a great book. If you want to read something great on Elvis, read the last chapter of Mystery Train, entitled Elvis Presleyad. Still, Marcus writing at only medium speed leaves most other critics of popular culture in the dust. In an interview he gave in the August issue of Lingua Franca, Marcus says he likes to work in the dark, to let his passion for his subject rule him, instead of relying on theory that fixes the questions and the answers in advance. The scattered insights of dead Elvis may leave Elvis's posthumous mystery too much intact, but I'll dance in the dark with Marcus any time.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Dead Elvis by Greil Marcus. We'll talk with Greil Marcus after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is rock critic Greil Marcus, author of the new book, Dead Elvis. Before we talk, here's a short reading from the first essay in the book.
This is the first piece in my book, Dead Elvis, and it's a piece I wrote when I found out that Elvis died. I was in Hawaii on vacation, and Rolling Stone called. I was working for Rolling Stone at the time, and they said, "You got to write about Elvis." So I did, and this is what I wrote. Like most other people my age, 32, Elvis mattered to me in the 50s. I loved his music, bought some of his records, and never went to any of his movies. He was thrilling, but he was also weird, and I kept my distance. Clearly, though, I had some sort of buried fascination with the man, and when he appeared on TV late in 1968 for his comeback, I found I could handle the fascination. In fact, I was caught up in it, and for the next 5 years, I spent far more time listening to Elvis's music from the beginning on down than to the music of anyone else. I found, or anyway I decided, that Elvis contained more of America, had swallowed whole more of its contradictions and paradoxes, than any other figure I could think of. I found that he was a great original artist, and I found that neither of these propositions was generally understood. So I wrote about it all, feeling, after 20,000 words, that I had only scratched the surface.
Greil, why have you remained so interested in the manifestations of the dead Elvis over the years?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One reason is that I think there is a great mystery in Elvis's music, and that's the mystery of how he managed to come out of nowhere and affect so many people, me included, so deeply. That's part of it. The other part is that after Elvis died, one would have expected him to freeze, to become fixed as a kind of single, sterile image, which is what happens to so many dead leaders, dead pop stars. And that didn't happen. The opposite happened. After Elvis died, all kinds of people began to recreate him in their own way. They recreated him as a horrible, bloated, fat dope addict. They recreated him as a saint. And they began to recreate him as the years went by in ever stranger incarnations. Elvis Hitler, Elvis Nixon, Elvis Christ. And I just was awestruck. And simply as a fan, as someone who was paying casual attention, I just began to clip and save every strange manifestation I came across with no particular purpose, the way someone obsessively collects newspapers when they're oppressed by the news. And after a while, I realized this story wasn't going away. It was just getting bigger and more interesting. And so many of these manifestations of Elvis's presence in our culture seemed meaningless by themselves, but connected to all the others that were swimming around them. I knew there was some kind of story there, and I wanted to try and tell it.
So how many articles do you have by women who were impregnated by Elvis's ghost?
I have a few. I mean, I don't have whole articles in the book about that, but I write about that because there are people who talk about it. Lucy DeBarbin wrote a book called Are You Lonesome Tonight? The Untold Story of Elvis Presley's One True Love and the Child He Never Knew. It was a national bestseller. It was an amazing book. This woman wrote about the love affair that she had had with Elvis, beginning long before he became famous and lasting until his death. She became pregnant twice by Elvis, and she had one child She, of course, never told him about any of this, and she lived her whole life as a silent partner of Elvis Presley. And she wrote the story of her love affair with Elvis in enormous detail, and it is one of the most scary, pathological books I've ever read. I mean, I don't know for a fact what to make of any of this, but as I read the book, I was reading a truly psychotic autobiography of a woman who was not lying, who believed every word she was saying, and who, in a way, had acted out a response to Elvis that millions of people shared. And what I mean by that is that so many people say, of all sorts, that when they heard Elvis, they had the feeling that he was singing right to them. And I think this woman had the same response, except she made it into a life.
You know, they still show a lot of Elvis movies on TV, and the other day I was watching, I think it was Easy Come, Easy Go. It's a 1967 movie. He's with the Navy, and it was really depressing. I kept thinking about how alienated he must have been making this movie. Here it is. It's 1967. There's a consciousness about Vietnam already in the United States. The counterculture has started. Psychedelic music is coming onto the radio. And Elvis is singing the squarest songs imaginable in a movie in which he's in the Navy. And he's so completely out of step with what's happening, like, in the vanguard of American
right.
culture. And you wonder, like, what is going through his mind? He can't even like the music. I mean, this is, like, really the worst of, you know, Hollywood musical square music. Do you often think about how alienated he must have been during parts of his life from what his career was turning into?
Well, he would sometimes throw up before he had to sing those songs.
The movie songs?
Right. I mean, not with everyone, and I'm not saying
probably
that
with
as,
these.
I'm not saying that as a metaphor.
Yeah.
He would sometimes actually throw up, and I think there was a tremendous sense of self-hatred because he knew he had become simply a cog in a factory. But I think he was so imprisoned by the limits that he had accepted. In other words, he acted in the 50s, I believe, as someone who wanted to shock the country, who wanted to threaten the country, who wanted to live in a different world. I think when you watch him in the old films of his 1956 TV appearances, the insouciance and the provocativeness is just obvious. This is not just some naive country boy doing what comes naturally. And I think in a way, he must have gone too far for himself. He must have been scared of how far he'd gone. He must have, well, think of what it meant to live from the time he was 21 years old in a society where everybody knew who he was, and half the people in the society hated him, and half the people worshipped him. Imagine carrying that. So I think he needed to get back. He went so far back that it was almost impossible for him to get out again. And that's why the sense of release in the 68 TV show is so profound and scary and tragic, because that great burst of freedom then turns into the same prison, the Las Vegas prison, very quickly.
And in this TV show, he's just wearing, I think, like jeans and a leather jacket, and he has his musicians behind him just backing him up on, you know, a couple of guitars and a bass. It's real music. It's not the kind of glitter and surface that...
Well, it starts out, he's sitting on stage. This is the first time he's been before an audience in 9 years. And Scotty Moore, his original guitar player, has an electric guitar. DJ Fontana, his original drummer, has drumsticks, but no drums. He's beating on a guitar case. And there are a couple friends around. El, come on, El, do it, El. And he starts out strumming an acoustic guitar, and he's parodying his old songs. He makes fun of them. And then it's as if he's sick of that, and he takes the electric guitar away from Scotty Moore, and he starts to play it. Now, this is the first time anyone had ever seen Elvis Presley play an electric guitar, and also the last. Shocking. He can play. Not only can he play, he can really play. He doesn't play complicated Eric Clapton riffs. He plays like a bluesman in an after-hours club. It's noise and it's rhythm. And then passion takes over, and he begins to sing old songs in a way he never sang them. He begins to sing songs that he made great records of, and he turns those records into ashes. it's staggering. It's astonishing. And you realize how scared he must have been. And then he reaches a point in the concert or the show or whatever it was, he's not scared anymore. And he knows that he can do something he never did before. And he just charges ahead and does it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is rock critic Greil Marcus, and he has a new book called Dead Elvis. That's a collection of pieces, including new pieces, about the manifestations of Elvis since his death. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. The shelling of Dubrovnik, once again, is looking very, very serious, and the Europeans are puzzling about what to do to stop it. We have news that North Korea may be another nuclear power. The United States is attempting now to pressure the North Koreans to stop building their way toward the bomb by asking our allies in Southeast Asia to use their good offices with North Korea. We also will be taking a look at the situation in the Soviet Union, where yet another ethnic minority is causing problems for the leadership, and we'll be remembering veterans on Veterans Day.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Greil Marcus is my guest. His new book is called Dead Elvis. I want to get back to your collection of Elvis manifestations in our culture, the Dead Elvis collection. What are some of the recent things that you've clipped or filed?
Well, the most amazing thing that there are two things that I found recently that are completely different and yet somehow are the borders of this story to me. One is an Elvis phone sex tape that's circulating on public radio in Australia and has been for a couple of years, although it was made in New Jersey. A performance artist called up a real phone sex worker, and he said, okay, you know, this is what I want to do, and they got into it, and she's urging him on, and suddenly he stops. He says, stop, I'm Elvis. I'm dead. You have to bring me back to life. And she gets very rattled. She doesn't know what she's supposed to do. And he says, you have to bring me alive again. Come on, do it. And so she begins doing her phone sex stuff, trying to bring Elvis back to life, or this, you know, this freak on the other end of the line. But she's very nervous, and at one point he says, okay, I have to hear That's All Right. Sing That's All Right for me. And she knows the song, Elvis's first record, and she starts to sing it in this very tremulous voice. And he says, I'm coming back to life. I'm coming back to life. Come on, keep going. And yeah, she's just having a fit because this is scary. Well, finally, it ends. And the performance artist tries to pull the string. He says, gee, that was really great. Suppose I call you up next week and we'll do it again, and I'll be Barry Manilow. And she says, I don't think so. She says, I'll do Elvis again, but I won't do Barry Manilow. So she throws it back at him. That's one. And it is a harrowing thing to listen to. The other story, the other manifestation, I came across just a couple of days ago. And it's in a story about what was going on in Moscow during the coup. What happened was this. After Boris Yeltsin went out and got on that tank, and he gave his speech. He went back into the White House, and he called John Major, the Prime Minister of England, and he said to him, I don't know how much time there is left for me. And then he locked the door of his office, and he sat down, and he put on Are You Lonesome Tonight? And he just sat there listening to it.
Now, how'd you hear about this?
This is based on interviews with Yeltsin that were done recently. Now, I love that story.
That's a great story. How often do you go back and listen to your Elvis records?
I guess about every few months I have a need to hear a song. And I'll say, oh, I just have to hear Any Day Now, which is a ballad he recorded in 1969. And then one song will lead me to another, and 3 hours later I'm still playing them.
Your Elvis collection, do you have it filed systematically?
In no way. When I started collecting this stuff, and that's even too fancy a word. When I started throwing these things onto a shelf is more like it. That's what I did. I threw things onto a shelf with no particular purpose in mind. And then the shelf became a bookcase, and then it became two bookcases with huge piles of worthless junk and fascinating images. And when it came time to write this book, I simply went through the piles again and pulled out the stuff that seemed the most striking or the most unsettling, and just picked, but I don't have anything filed in any way.
When you're in a store and you see some, like, Elvis bourbon or an Elvis salt shaker, do you buy it?
No. No, those are... I got to tell the truth. I went out and looked for an Elvis bourbon bottle. And I looked and I looked. It was hard to find. And I found one, and it cost a lot of money. And I bought it anyway, because there was something so perverse about it that you twist the head off the bottle and you pour the bourbon out of the neck, that I just couldn't resist. And I still have that bottle. But that's the last thing that I bought. When Love Me Tender Chunks were put on the market, you know, the first Elvis licensed product after he died was Always Elvis, which was advertised as the wine Elvis would have drunk if he drank wine. When Love Me Tender Chunks were put on the market, they were not advertised as the dog food Elvis would have eaten if he'd been a dog, but fans immediately came up with that slogan. And I thought about buying a big 20-pound bag of that stuff and just sticking it in the corner of my attic, but I didn't do it.
You know, a recurring question that gets asked in your book is, did Elvis go to heaven or hell?
Right.
Is this a question that you think a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about?
Yeah, and I think some people think about it very, very seriously, and some people think about it as a tremendous joke, and underneath that joke is great seriousness. My feeling is, and I have a whole gallery of images in this book, 15 or 16 pictures that show Elvis in heaven and Elvis in hell. And as you look at these pictures, you realize, and they're all made by different artists, you realize that hell looks like a lot of fun, and heaven looks really terrible, very oppressive. My feeling is that Elvis gets to commute.
Rock critic Greil Marcus, his new book, Dead Elvis, is published by Doubleday.
Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis, Bob Alls, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Gary Sick was an aide to President Carter during the Iranian hostage crisis. Now Sick charges that in 1980, the Reagan campaign made a secret deal with the Iranians not to release the American hostages until after the election. In the new book, October Surprise, Sick tries to reconstruct the story. We'll talk with Gary Sick on the next Fresh Air.